Oliver Nelson and Eric Dolphy with 6 and 4. It's from their 1961 album, Straight Ahead. Nelson on alto and tenor sax, Dolphy on alto and bass clarinet and flute, Richard Wines on piano, George Duvivier on double bass, and Roy Haynes on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. If it seemed that the federal investigation of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation had stalled or was eclipsed by prosecutions emanating from the Mueller probe, that just might be a wrong reading. In fact, well-placed sources are telling Lead Stories that there is a major gearing up afoot with at least 2 airplane loads of documents relating to the Clintons and the eponymous foundation recently shipped out to investigators. Charles Ortel, a retired Wall Street banker turned financial investigator, has been tracking the Clinton Foundation and its affiliated spinoffs all over the world for several years. He blew the lid off Wall Street crime during the 2008-2009 crash when he proved through his own research that several major corporations were overvaluing their stock. His self-initiated probe of the Clinton Foundation has led him to conclude that it is a cleverly designed slush fund for the Clintons and, as he put it, the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in history. So he brings us up to speed today on the Clinton Foundation probes currently in play, both in the United States and in several other countries. And Charles, it's great to have you with us once again.
It's my honor to be back with you, Eutrice.
Well, 2 plane loads of documents. This is an indication that things are getting very serious. What do you think?
Well, so the stories, it was interesting. There were multiple stories in the Little Rock press in both radio and print and stuff last week about, you know, a Department of Justice-owned 757 that was parked out, you know, on the tarmac in the airport there, the Bill and Hillary Clinton airport, in plain view with a lot of activity, people with FBI jackets and DEA jackets and even, I think, IRS jackets, what was happening. And people I talked to told me that they thought it was very much having to do with the Clinton Foundation. Multiple people, you know, former employees of three-letter agencies, suggested that it most likely had to do with the Clinton Foundation. Then the Department of Justice, I think, or the FBI, or both, issued a press release saying that they had rounded up this local drug gang, and you know, they're trying to claim that, you know, maybe these jets had something more to do with that. But when they describe in the press releases the scale of the drug bust, the amounts involved, you know, 2 kilograms of cocaine. I mean, that you don't need a 757, which is a large plane, to scoop up, I don't think, evidence relating to 2 kilograms, of, if that's the right number, of coke and related stuff. So I think it's likely a mixture of both. And I can say, because I've now spent, actually I shudder to say how long it is, but it's 3.5 years on this, almost to the day today. And when you really go over this record and when you learn about what the charity laws are, when you learn that this is very different than for-profit land, you know, when you go out and you, Jed Clampett, for example, the Beverly Hillbillies, he's out in his, wherever he was in Appalachian in fictional life, and he shoots his gun into the ground, and he's hunting for some kind of animal, and up pops crude, and he becomes an instant millionaire, billionaire, whatever it is. You could do that in for-profit land. You can go hunting for animals and come back with a, you know, gusher full of oil, and there's no problem. But in charity land, you can't do that. You can't go out and say, I'm a presidential library and research center. I'm raising money across state lines, using telephone, using the mail, using the internet. I said I would do it only with personal meetings. Instead, it's going to be a widespread thing using, again, the mails and telephone and internet. And I'm going to tell everybody that what the money will be used for is for this presidential library and research center, which will only be based in Little Rock and therefore only have people in Little Rock working for it. And suddenly say, you know what? On second thought, I'm going to fight from New York and Boston. I'm going to fight climate change and HIV/AIDS, and I'm just not going to tell anybody about it. That's a crime called conversion. It's where you go out and you say, I'm raising, $10,000. I ask you, Therese Leader, I ask your listeners for $10,000 for a library, and instead I use it to fly around the world and fight HIV/AIDS. You can't do that. And the statutes, the federal statutes and local statutes, international statutes are crystal clear on this. And so, you know, the big question, as you and I have discussed in the past, is not whether this is an ongoing fraud. Of course it's a fraud. It's been a fraud since inception. The big question is, why have politicians in both parties, Republicans and Democrats, now for going on 21 years, allowed this fraud to start at the $3 million declared level and escalate to the $3 billion declared level with unaccounted for monies that you have to estimate that could be in the $100 billion or more? Why have so many people and so many political parties? And I think I know the answer why. I think the answer...
What do you think?
Well, this is new. We're going to break some news here. I hadn't studied carefully enough the George H.W. Bush Foundation until recently. And when I did, I noticed that it was opened on November 4th and 5th, 1997. And this fellow who was the president of the William J. Clinton Presidential Foundation, his name is James L. Rutherford, but he goes by Skip Rutherford. He made the mistake of giving a press conference or an interview with C-SPAN that you can see on November 7th, 1997, where he said, you know, we had formed a group, and I'm paraphrasing, we'd formed a group and we reviewed 36 sites and we winnowed it down to six, and the president and Hillary Clinton have selected this site in downtown Little Rock is to be the site. They made that announcement on November 7th, 1997. Well, the William J. Clinton Presidential Foundation was only set up on October 23rd, 1997. How in the heck do you study 36 different sites, not just in New York, in Little Rock, but in multiple places? How do you study all that? How do you winnow it down to six when your organization wasn't even created until October 23rd, 1997? And how did Bill, the sitting president of the United States, and his wife, the First Lady, how do they decide where the location is going to be? They have no connection to the Clinton Foundation, no official connection to the Clinton Foundation at that point in time. And in addition, in this time frame, the Clinton Foundation had not created, when you set up a corporation, you can't set up a fictitious corporation. It has to be truly a real corporation with independent board and this and that. And to do that, you have to get what's called a federal employer identification number, FEIN, or some people just call it EIN. They didn't even get that. They didn't even apply for it until December 23rd, 1997. So when you look carefully at this record, this thing was a fiction from the beginning. And then I noticed that this Skip Rutherford says in this press release that he had been down at the opening of the H.W. Bush Foundation, and that some things were above politics. We've been studying this together, and we're close association. And lo and behold, it turns out that the person who accepted the donation of the H.W. Foundation in Houston, I think it is, that person was John W. Carlin, the archivist of the United States at that point. He's the same John W. Carlin who accepts the Clinton Foundation donation November 18, 2004. And the project, the way this stuff works, you, Therese, and your listeners, the way this works is the property, the records of the presidency are defined by the Presidential Records Act of 1978. And they include all the records created or received. And it's very specific. You can't just say, well, you know, these incriminating records that make me look bad, we're going to burn them. And the ones that make me look good, we're going to put them in the archive. No, the National Archives requires is required to get all of the records of a presidency. And then if an independent presidential foundation complies with the laws in the Presidential Libraries Act of 1955, amended in 1986, if it complies with the laws, and if the archivist certifies, which the archivist has to do, that it has complied with the laws, then the archivist can turn these presidential records, all of them, over to the foundation. Well, what has happened in the Bush case and in the Clinton case is that records were nominally under the control of the National Archives at temporary facilities in the case of the George H.W. Bush thing, I think, in Texas. But in Little Rock, I know it was in a former car dealership. And from press releases, we understand that these records were spirited out of Little Rock late in 2000 after the election, but before Bill had left. A large volume of records are spirited out then and then early in January. And then we know from other reporting and analysis that records remain behind in D.C. and eventually were sent in mid-July 2001. So there, with regard to the Clinton records and the H.W. records, the same person who had control of, you know, sitting on top of these things before the foundation was built, the building was built, is a man whose last name is Alsobrook, Alsobrook. He did it for H.W., and he did it for Clinton. Now, when we go back into history, what is one of the biggest unsolved mysteries about the Reagan-Bush era? It's what really happened at Iran-Contra and what really happened in, you know, Mena, Arkansas, and other places. And here is the H.W. Library is where H.W.'s vice presidential records and presidential records are housed. So here we have, you know, the same archivist, the same manager of these records, I would argue conspiring. And I think we in the United States of America, it's not like we pay nothing in taxes. We pay a lot of money in taxes. A lot of records are created. A lot of records should be kept. And these records should be, you know, in time, as time passes and, you know, the secrecy period lapses, you know, we should be able to see all these records, and historians should be able to study all these records. And I suspect that what may have happened here is in the H.W. period is 81, January 20th, 81, through January 20th, 1993. Now, that's pre-internet, right? In the Clinton, it's post-internet, the bulk of his records. And I suspect there was some sort of shady side deal here, you know, where, you know, you won't look too closely into our records that may have gone missing, and we won't look too closely into your records. And I think we need to get to the bottom of this. And so this is a new set of angles. It would explain why, under W. Bush, people did not aggressively enough look into the massive fraud that escalated at the Clinton Foundation. Would explain a lot.
Well, it would explain a lot, but then we don't know what we're looking for.
Well, I'm not sure of that. I think that the way, you know, I've been involved with this kind of stuff before in business, and where you get tripped up, you know, if somebody says, all right, Charles, I want you to turn over all your records on a project that goes over the course of 3.5 years. And that's tens of thousands of pages. And so I say, well, I'll give them 8,000. I'll hold back 2. And first of all, just to comprehend what's in 8,000 pages, and here we're talking about 80 million pages, but just for one person to comprehend 8,000 pages, not so easy. And chances are that you will miss, you know, you're not going to remember every line and every letter. And so I was involved in a situation where, you know, somebody claimed they gave me all the records, and I got, you know, let's just call it an amount of records equal to X, and then push and shove, and I get a conveyance by a lawyer saying, actually, the real records are 8X, and here they are, right? So I know that they lied to me once, and I take a look at the 8X, and I discover, you know, in response to your letter of March 23rd, 1993, you know, there's a communication April 15th, 1993, I say A, B, and C. But there's no letter March 23rd, 1993 in the second conveyance. That's the kind of stuff that when you start pulling on all this, there's got to be a series of communications. There's got to be a lot of documents here. And if you put a team on this, a real team, not the way they investigated Hillary Clinton when Barack Obama was president, you put some real top-notch investigators on the question of what's in the H.W. Bush library going all the way back to matters of 1981 forward. What are the communications between the H.W. interim team and the Clinton team? Exactly what was the Clinton Foundation doing prior to, or people associated with the Clinton Foundation doing prior to October 23rd, 1997? And I have a theory on this. You know, when you, a working theory, when you go back, there's a book called, I think, The Secret Tapes by somebody who Bill Clinton was thinking about, Taylor Branch is his name, was thinking about hiring a taxpayer expense to be a contemporaneous historian, recording what was going on in his presidency from the very beginning. Bill Clinton met with this guy after the election in 92, but before the inauguration. And Taylor Branch then produced a book that was published in, I think, 2009 that has, I think, some incriminating disclosures in it about how far ahead Bill had been thinking about this. And you put yourself, and it's commonplace, this kind of stuff, when you have a big building project in a city that where a portion of it's derelict. And, you know, the Clinton Foundation decided after the 36 sites were considered to build it in a portion of, I think, Little Rock. It might have been North Little Rock, I forget which, but it's, you know, it's a portion of that area, that metroplex, that was derelict that was needed to be rehabilitated. So if you know you're a person in Arkansas, and you're an insider, and you know the ultimate site selection of this presidential library, and you know that it's a gigantic project in Arkansas terms, then you know how to make a tremendous amount of money. You snap up derelict land for pennies on the dollar. You wait for the announcement. Suddenly you've got, you know, massive projects or condos or different things that you might do around hotels, maybe even around this complex. So I think the FBI needs to take a very hard look at, you know, from really the election of 92, I forget the date of that election, but the day that Clinton won, from that moment forward, all property transactions around the present site of the Clinton Foundation need to be examined very closely to see who was buying up the land there, who may have had advance notice, who profited from doing transactions. The Clinton Foundation brags, foolishly, in my view, in various disclosures, that I think they say that there was $2 billion of economic activity created around this project. Now, nobody really knows yet how much actually was spent on the project itself. There's contradictory evidence in the public filings. The lease that was signed with the city of Little Rock to get the land says they were going to spend about $100 million on the project. That's signed March 1st, 2002. Of that $100 million, $26 million was for landscaping. So the balance, $74 million, is a construction cost. How in the heck do you argue, as they have been arguing, that they really spent $165 million on it? Now, to put this in context, we found reference to a building permit entered into in, I think it was, May-June time frame 2002, where there's reference to it that's saying that the stated costs were $83.7 million, and that amount was so large in that year, it represented approximately 24% the value of all construction activity in that region. So, in that city. So $83 million, if that's 24%, how in the heck do you now claim that it costs you $165 million in a period where the actual economic conditions in Little Rock were not great? There's no real strong argument why the cost should have gone up that much. And then, you know, by the way, how come there's no financial accounting? You actually have to get an accounting firm to go and take a look at what was really spent. How come there is no audit? Contemporaneous audit that where an accountant hires an expert and says, okay, this is the cost, but here's the value of this thing on November 18th, 2004, the date they claim that, you know, the facility opened to the public and all was hunky-dory. How come there's no work there validating that amount? Very, very suspicious. And then, you know, how come the accounting firm that was chosen is an accounting firm, BKD LLP, that, you know, was formed by merger, but it appears not to have its paperwork done properly to be an accounting firm in Arkansas, under Arkansas law? And how come it was working, you know, when you, in accounting land, you have to be careful when you render an independent audit that you're actually independent. How could BKD have been, as they were apparently, auditor to the city of Little Rock, who was leasing the land to the foundation, auditor to the foundation, and auditor to Project Heifer International, which is another charity that I think has issues, that was subleasing land from the Clinton Foundation, on which they were building their headquarters for much less money than the Clinton Foundation did, using the same contracting firm, CDI, whose chief financial officer died under mysterious circumstances in January of 2008. I mean, there's quite a story to be told here, I think. And I hope the investigators that are listening to this, if they're listening, are digging in and demanding a real thorough investigation into, to coin a phrase, what happened.
So in this light, what do you think these plane loads of documents may actually, what is the story they may actually tell?
Well, so when you get involved, as I have been involved with much smaller foundations, and you're soliciting funds across state lines, then there is a raft of paperwork you have to fill out. It's not like you can just, you know, get on in your car and go to, you know, go to, let's pick a tough state, California, and say, you know, I'm building this thing in Little Rock, and I'm just going to start having parties at Steven Spielberg's house and raise money. Before you solicit penny one in California, you know, assuming you're going for a certain size that the Clintons went for right away, you've got to go to the state of California. First of all, you've got to register your foundation inside California, and then you've got to fill out a whole bunch of paperwork under penalties of perjury, saying, you know, explaining what you're doing, why, if you're going to raise money, why you're raising it, who are the agents that you're using to raise this money for you, what is the sales pitch you're going to use. In some states, you actually have to write that out and tell the regulator. And you can't roll your, you know, jalopy into California and say, I'm raising all this money for something in Little Rock, when in fact what you're going to do is take the money and fight HIV/AIDS or earthquake relief in India or Haiti or Katrina. You can't do that. And the other thing you can't do, you're asked in each of these, many of these states, if any people associated with the effort have defects, I'm being polite here, defects in their records, you've got to disclose that. You cannot use an unauthorized, you know, a fundraiser that's not registered in California, that, or a fundraiser that has failed to disclose that it solicited money for charities, including the Clinton Foundation, in multiple states when it wasn't registered. You can't go into California and not tell them that the state of Mississippi has disciplined you not once, not twice, but three times for soliciting money inside the state and failing to register, three times, paying penalty. You can't do, and you can't pay penalties for that. They're small money to the Clintons, you know, several thousand, I think 20,000 or something like that. But you can't use the foundation's resources to pay a fine. You can't do that, but they did that. And they used this other O'Brien, McConnell, and Pearson, and I think it's now called OMP. It's a big fundraising firm that was disciplined in 2002 by the state of Pennsylvania. They haven't disclosed any of this. And so you think about the paperwork of, you know, let's say you want to do this, all 50 states. Not all the states have the same approach, but most of them, you've got to fill out a form. You're sending it across state lines by definition. The other thing to remember is that foundations, the first step for a foundation once it's organized properly, which the Clinton Foundation in my mind never was, is you've got to then go to the IRS and say, okay, I want to get federal tax exemption. With that, once you go through that process, and it should be rigorous, at least the regulations suggest it's rigorous, once you go through that process, you're only part of the way there. If you want to get a donor in Illinois to get a tax exemption from the prohibitively high taxes of the state of Illinois, you have to apply for exemption from state taxes in Illinois. And New York and California and Massachusetts, even in Arkansas, you have to do it. So when you start thinking through the paperwork, just before you've raised a penny, before you've built anything, there's a massive amount of paperwork you've got to get done right. Then the process of building a building. I mean, I'm no master builder or anything like that, as certain people in the White House are. But, you know, if you want to get a gigantic project done involving, you know, building a structure like this thing where you're moving a lot of earth around and reconfiguring, you know, the way in which water may, you know, go across the property into the river, you're on a riverfront property, you've got to think about sewer, you've got to think about pollution, you've got to think about electricity, you've got to think about, you know, all sorts of stuff, and wetlands and, you know, who knows what else. Then you got to have the building built to the proper specifications. You put it typically out to bid. There's all kinds of, you know, paperwork back and forth. Who's actually paying the bills from what bank account? They're typically for construction projects that I'm familiar with. There's an amazing amount of paperwork back and forth about change orders and, you know, monthly bills, reconciling all the purchases, da da da. There's masses of paperwork that would let you then construct a timeline of saying, you know, what bank accounts were opened in the name of this foundation, by which people, which branches, did they have the authority to open these bank accounts and securities accounts, why were bank accounts open in Massachusetts to fight HIV/AIDS, who decided to do that, when those bank accounts were open, were they open lawfully, did the person who opened them have the authority to actually open that account, where's the evidence of that? Did they use the proper name of the foundation? Which is the answer is no, they have never used the proper name of the foundation anywhere, as far as I can tell. Did they fill out, you know, all their legal paperwork, their corporate forms, their annual reports, their minutes? None of that was done right. And the reason I bring all this up is when you're so far away from being a validly organized and operated independent nonprofit corporation, you run the risk, when people step in, of saying, you know, look, this has never been a corporation. It's never been a charity. It's just a formless aggregation, which is a term of art. It's just a bunch of people running around the world. You know, by 2009, I just went over this yesterday on my show, I believe the travel expenses of this thing were $10 million or so by 2009. How do you spend $10 million on travel running around the world fighting climate change when you're supposed to be just a research center and presidential archive in Little Rock? And how did nobody notice any of this? So the answer, Teresa, is the volume of money they claim they spent just in the introductory period, October 23, 1997 to December 31st, 2009, before the reorganization of the Clinton Foundation, the purported reorganization happened, they claim they raised over $900 million. And, you know, let's take their estimate is being correct, which I think is false. Let's use it. Let's say it cost $165 million, but they raised $900 million for it, and nobody stood there and said, "Now wait a minute, the thing only cost $165 million. Why are we raising $900 million? What are we doing with this money?" You know, nobody stood to ask that. Nobody, no trustee stood up and said, "You know what? I'm a trustee. I have legal liability here. If this is a fraud, I have no protection, you know, from the entity itself. I probably have no insurance." Nobody stood up there and said, you know, why don't we have any of this paperwork done right? And then the issue of the grants. So big donors like the Gates Foundation, they're in big trouble if they claim to on their IRS forms that they gave money to what is called a public charity, in this case a publicly supported charity, a specific type of public. They say to the IRS, we gave, you know, all in, I think they've made 150 grants or so over the life of this, their association, each time saying, you know, we gave it either to the parent foundation or we gave it to Clinton Health Access Initiative, and that in both cases they're publicly supported, but they're not. The IRS, you know, can, and to date has not yet, go to the Gates Foundation and say, listen, you know, this is not a small problem. We think that you're nothing more than you're just currying favor with the Clinton family to protect Microsoft, or, you know, make some argument like that. You should not be you should not have the considerable benefits that are afforded private individuals who set up private foundations. For example, you shouldn't have had the benefit of being able to take a gigantic tax deduction against your personal income taxes for the donation of appreciated Microsoft stock. You shouldn't have been allowed to do that. You shouldn't have been allowed in the foundation to have these assets that you placed in there appreciate tax-free. You just shouldn't have been allowed to do any of that, and we're going to wind you up retroactively. So with that hammer over something like the Gates Foundation, normally you would get a staff together and you'd say, all right, Clinton Foundation, we're giving you $10 million this year, but you're going to write us this voluminous report where you're going to tell us exactly what you did with the money, and we want to be sure that you did not, you know, waste our money, or we want to be crisp. There should be due diligence files. Just because somebody tells you that things are okay one day doesn't mean that things don't change the next day. And so there's a burden on the donor, if you're a private foundation, to ride the Clinton Foundation hard, to do your diligence first and ride it really hard, which would mean letters back and forth, emails, et cetera. Where's all that stuff? And they've claimed, you know, on these donations, the Clintons themselves, the Clinton Foundation, has given a long, long list of American and other entities out there that, you know, they say have given them money. And you're the IRS with powerful computers. You could simply say, all right, I want to cross-check all these names. I want to see the reports of the Gates Foundation year by year, and I want to compare them to the Clinton Foundation. Rockefeller Foundation, Clinton Foundation. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Clinton Foundation. Pritzker Foundation, Children's Investment Foundation. And you'll go on and on and on. And it would take about a week, if you were serious and had the resources of the IRS, to say this is a massive fraud. And why are people, you know, why has this been allowed to run for as long as it? How could Rod Rosenstein and Bob Mueller and James Comey spend 4 years from 2001 to 2005 as the fraud escalated and not notice that in each of those 4 years, the name that is used for the Clinton Foundation as its name is not its real name, that there isn't a valid audit, that the address is not – the basic mistakes and the numbers don't work and the accounting policies aren't – how do you not see this having spent 4 years on it as the Department of Justice, the IRS, with all those resources? How do you not see this? That, you know, that to me is the interesting part of this scandal. If just before we went on air, Donald Trump tweeted out in response to Peter Stroke having been fired, we learned on Friday – his most recent tweet that I saw several minutes ago said that it is that the man who led the witch hunt of that wasn't a real investigation of Hillary Clinton's mishandled classified emails has just been fired. We need to redo the investigation into Hillary Clinton for mishandling classified email. And President Trump on that is 100% correct. And when you do that, you go right into the heart of the Clinton Foundation. Why didn't the IRS and the Department of Justice, why is it taking so long for them to expose what really happened at the Clinton Foundation? And by the way, the Clinton Foundation is just now under the same hammer that we put them in 2016. They have to file their tax returns November 15th, 2018. And they have to disclose, because I have made publicly aware people, we did a video, or we're doing these videos now that get a lot of focus. We did one yesterday, 2.5 hours long. As of airtime today, it has almost 10,000 views. And we take people through in rigorous detail the fact that the Clintons raised $918 million for a library, but used it for who knows what. That's called a material diversion. It's a crime. And it needs to be explained on these tax forms, which are due November 15th, 2018. So each passing day, you got to explain that. You got to explain why the crooked accounting firm BKD, the Little Rock branch, why they were the named either tax advisor or accountant beginning by 1998 or so, right the way through to 2013. Why did the trustees continue to use this firm that had missed charitably massive fraud over a long period of time and issued countless fraudulent statements that were relied upon by donors? Why did the trustees continue to use this firm? And you know, the difference now, Eutrice, between 2018 and 2016, it is only now that there is a new, I think, a new IRS chief has been named. I don't know if he's finally been confirmed and he's on site, but there's a new IRS chief. There are new U.S. attorneys. It's a different cast of characters. It's not the team that thought they were going to get away with rigging the 2016 election and just waltzing Hillary Clinton. And no, it's a different group that's going to look at the facts and evidence. And across the political spectrum, you know, people need to really look at this. We need to see the whole story. We need to see how badly wrong this went so that we
find out. Let's talk, Charles, about what is the ancillary development, or what are the ancillary developments in other parts of the world? The United States clearly is remiss in doing just basic accounting, and it would seem to suggest that the Clintons benefited from a wide web of organized protection that allowed them to do the most scandalous things under the umbrella of a charity foundation. But sure. What is going on in other parts of the world that have begun to look very closely at the Clinton Foundation? And could you give us a kind of some estimate, in your view, of the kind of money we are talking about here that has disappeared? And the third question is, taking a tip from the Manafort trial, is it possible that the Clintons hid a lot of money in a lot of places overseas, in a lot of banks?
Sure. Well, I'll try to remember all three questions and answer them. So you're practicing, I guess, to be a White House pool reporter, right? Anyway, it's a multi-part question. So the first question is, what's going on around the world? Obviously, the rules are strict in most countries, so I don't really know precisely, nor do I want to know precisely, what individual teams around the world are doing. What I do know is that from 1998, the first year they filed a tax form, through 2007, though the Clinton Foundation did in fact receive massive amounts of money from governments, they claimed on their IRS tax forms that they received no money from governments. And, you know, that, if you're sitting there as a government, you got to wonder. I mean, you got to have somebody in, you know, these countries like the United Kingdom and France, Australia, Norway, New Zealand, et cetera. Somebody's got to look at this and say, hang on, you know, we gave them, in Australia's case, nearly $100 million. How come they're saying nothing? You know, nothing went. And so the game that I think, the bad game, the crime that has been going on here is that so many of these politicians, these national leaders, you know, they labor in politics. They don't make a tremendous amount of money. They're not billionaires. And then they get thrust into the global spotlight, and they start, you know, flying around the world, Pasha class and private jets and presidential suites and fancy meals and this and that, and they get used to that lifestyle. And it just really, if you don't have economic training, business training, and, you know, and if you're not lucky and hardworking, it's very tough to start with nothing and become a billionaire. Very, very hard. I mean, the press would make you seem as it's really easy. It's not easy. I mean, I'm not a billionaire, but it's not easy to get there. And so these people, you know, they watch the billionaires profit from, you know, their activity, and they get more and more envious. And I think, I don't think it's just Bill Clinton. I think there are a large number of former heads of state. There are these various groups. There's the Club de Madrid, of associations of former world leaders. And there are people who understand in business just how valuable a national leader can be. I mean, as we talked about in Arkansas, the person who says, you know, we're going to put the foundation on this site, has a lot of power. The person who says AT&T will not be allowed to merge with, you know, this company has a lot of value, or grants a wireless license, or takes, you know, offshore drilling off the ability of an oil company to drill. These are economic decisions that donors, you know, if they believe they can influence the administration, they'll find ways to, you know, get on the right side of somebody who can help them. And if the Clintons, who have a long record of persecuting their enemies, you know, if it also means by giving them money, you know, that you'll get on their, that you won't be persecuted, or if you are, you know, if the Eric Holder's Justice Department, Loretta Lynch's Justice Department decides to go after you, that maybe you won't get fined as much as you should have been fined. So, you know, there's a long, virtually every decision that was made in the Clinton administration, then the Bush administration, then the Obama administration, needs to be looked at again, marrying up how much money, you know, who was the person involved? Did they give money to these foundations, yes or no? Did they contribute to campaigns, yes or no? Did they get an economic benefit from the United States of America, or is it yes or no? And, you know, we'll see the swamp. If you go back, this is the swamp at work. So the international investigations, I was told this directly by people who had spoken to, you know, the citizens of other countries who had spoken to their government. The basic attitude prior to November 8th, 2016 is, you know, you could be right about all this, but we just do not want to get on the wrong side of the Clintons. So, you know, we're not doing anything until we see what happens on the election night. And then after the election, the attitude turned more to be, well, you know, we're not really sure he's going to, Trump will, you know, how long he'll be there. This investigation seems serious to us. Will he make it through that? And, you know, now, though, that Donald Trump has been in for, what, a year and a half or so, and that things seem to, or I should say, well before now, various and sundry governments began to take a hard look at this. And when they learned that there's a way for way to possibly get their money back, which I believe there is a way to do that, then they started changing their tunes. And so various, the largest donor to the Clinton Foundation, known donor to the actual legal entities that are known, is the government of France. And they have sent their money through an entity called Unité that's located in Geneva. And the government of France has indeed been looking at this. They looked at it once in 2009. Yeah,
talk about how much money they've donated.
Well, all in, Unitaid has given $650 million or so to the Clinton Foundation HIV-AIDS initiative that doesn't legally exist. And France's share of that, you could say it's over $300 million. Or you could take the more aggressive view and say, you know, France, it was France's idea to create Unitaid. So they need to bear responsibility not simply for to their own taxpayers for the 300 or so that went to this fraud, but they should really stand up and bear responsibility to the people they induced into to forming Unitaid. It was a project of Jacques Chirac and his former foreign minister, Philippe Douste Blazy, is a funny name. So you could take an aggressive view that they're on the hook for $650 million. And the problem with the French situation, of course, is they did have an investigation. Somebody spotted irregularities by December of 2009. An investigation was launched. There are public records of it. And yet they didn't discipline the Clinton Foundation. They continued giving money to the Clinton Foundation after the finish of the negotiation, which was an investigation, which was 2011. These are records that are public. They're in French, so it's a burden for those who don't speak French to go through them. But they're out there. You can see it. So the French are in there. The English are in there big time. They also contributed not only to Unitaid, but directly to various Clinton Foundation projects. And, you know, here I think we're running up against an interesting issue, which that, you know, there's been a lot of chatter about Russia, which has certainly been a rival, let's say, or even an enemy. But most Americans believe that the United Kingdom has been a friend. You know, notwithstanding that little pesky period, 1812 to 1814, we do have a special relationship with the United Kingdom. And I see in the records here that, you know, one of the reasons that the UK may be resisting an investigation into the Clinton Foundation is that Bill and Tony Blair were close. And, you know, a lot of these problems in the Clinton Foundation may have been seen as opportunities. In other words, that the British taxpayer, you know, is funding the cash for these programs. It's not coming out of British politicians' pockets. So you route money toward these problems, and then the Brits are in a position to tell the Clintons, look, you know, we know your foundations are fraud, and you're going to follow our lead on certain things here, or we're going to have to expose this. So I think there's, you know, the English, I don't know how aggressively they're going to be dragged, I think, into this by the French, who are, I believe, looking hard at it, and the rivalries between the French and the English are interesting. The Irish are locked down. You know, the Dennis O'Brien, this billionaire, owns most of the media in Ireland. They don't really have a functioning investigative journalist class of the same degree they once had because they can't get their stuff published. And it's to the same degree. But the Irish people, the long-suffering Irish people, have given a lot of money towards this fraud, and they deserve to know where it went. Not that somebody should care less or more about this because of their sexual preferences, but the Prime Minister of Ireland is a gay man, and you know, we've talked before about this, the HIV-AIDS crisis, the HIV-AIDS fraud in the Clinton Foundation, the distribution of adulterated drugs is an issue that all people should care deeply about it, but especially a gay man leading the country of Ireland should be asking soul-searching questions. Why did the Irish people funnel over 100 million euros towards an entity that was distributing watered-down, adulterated drugs manufactured by Ranbaxy, an Indian generic company that's, you know, you look up their record. So the Norwegians, another group I've reached out, most cases people contact me about this, a number of sources with ties to Norway originally were very, you know, downbeat about the prospects of getting any of their money back and doing right here. But because the Clintons are so good, Bill Clinton in particular, is so close to a number of Norwegians, and so many Norwegians, a small country, are wedded to the globalism project and involved in these, you know, senior positions at the World Health Organization, et cetera. But in recent months, that's changed. And, you know, the Norwegian people are looking at this, and there is, again, a way in Norway, a process to demand an audit of what happened and then to figure out who are these people in the Norwegian Treasury and elsewhere who are wiring money to bank accounts for entities that didn't exist? You know, why did you do this? You're supposed to be careful with your taxpayers' money. Same story in Australia. This is a process. I'll give credit to this person who's a journalist, Michael Smith, a wonderful man, an investigative journalist, former police detective, has been doggedly going after the Australian government and Malcolm Turnbull, and now in particular the Prime Minister. You know, why are you so quick to ignore this fraud and all this missing money? And, you know, how did the Clintons get away with operating in Australia? Were there laws about soliciting, that if you want to solicit funds in Australia, you got to register, and they didn't do so properly? You know, they didn't register their various aid projects funded with Australian money in Vietnam and Papua New Guinea and elsewhere. They didn't do that right. You know, why are you still funding this thing? And then down to New Zealand, brave people down there approached me and explained the lay of the land down there. And there's a new, very young person who's just given birth to her first child, who's the prime minister in New Zealand. And she, you know, is a left-leaning potential ally of the Clintons, but you know, here's a new mother looking at her new baby and learning that the New Zealand people, through their government, have been sending money towards a charity that has been distributing adulterated HIV/AIDS drugs, bound in some cases towards children. And how do babies get HIV and AIDS in 2018, when the risk of, you know, mother-to-child transmission of HIV and AIDS is far lower? You know, why are so many pediatric AIDS drugs being routed by the Clinton Foundation? And are these drugs, who tests them? So, you know.
Well, Charles, we kind of are very low on time.
Okay.
So we'll have to wrap up.
Okay.
And I think people are getting a very clear picture, a much clearer picture as we go, about how insanely crooked this whole thing is. And the surprising thing is that they've gotten away with this for so long, so long. And we have to know at some point who's who and who did what. And most importantly, where is the money?
Right.
I must mention to listeners that Charles has his own program now. He's had it for some time, called Sunday with Charles. It's a very, very finely detailed program. It goes on for sometimes two, even more hours. And everything that he talks about, he posts on charlesortel.com. So you come on Sunday at what time, Charles?
3 p.m.
3 p.m. And you can look out for Sunday with Charles. At that time, he would elaborate even further on topics today. But I want to thank you so much for being with us today, as always. And I know I'm excited about that plane load of documents that just took off. But where, too, by the way?
Well, thank you, Eutrice. And quick answer to the question, it's entirely possible that there are assets and bank accounts of which the Clintons are beneficiary all over the world, many places. It's entirely possible.
I think so, too. I think so, too. Lots of secret accounts. Maybe Manafort could help to tell us how to bank under very different names, all these hundreds. It's actually, do you think it's more than hundreds of billions of dollars, or it's in that category?
The missing money is around 100 billion or more. How much of it might have ended up in people connected to the Clintons is anybody's guess. And international mazes like this, it's very easy to park substantial assets right in plain sight, hiding in plain sight, by creating different legal forms and, you know, funny names and having intricate structures. You can hide a lot of money even today.
Well, I know with you on the case, it would be very, very hard to evade detection. So keep on it, and you can always count on us. Looking forward to your reports here.
Thank you.
And of course, you're on. Thanks so much for being with us today, Charles.
Thank you.
Thanks. And that brings us to the end of our program. As you know, we've been following the story for quite some time, and you just heard numbers that probably boggled your mind, like about $100 billion unaccounted for, and nobody has asked them. Nobody has put them in a court. Nobody has put them in under some kind of extra special probe to find out what they were doing and how it is that they got away with it for so long. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks. See you then.